Yes, you had a question?
So before we were talking about the hindrances.
Yep.
And I think it was recommending different ways to overcome the hindrances.
Mm-hmm.
In practical terms, would this apply in the beginning period of meditation, where you kind of maybe see what hindrance you have and then apply the strategy here?
I think that when you're using specific techniques to overcome specific hindrances, that you mainly use that when the hindrances themselves are fairly tenacious. You know, you just start out by doing your meditation and just do that as best you can, and the meditation itself will overcome all the hindrances. But you know, if you get, say, anger just keeps on coming up and up, then you need to do something about that. Or if, you know, tiredness just keeps happening again and again, if you just get a bit of tiredness and then you just keep meditating and then the tiredness goes away, then that's, don't need to do anything special for that. Yeah? That's just as a rule of thumb, yeah? Because the problem can be that if we're too reactive in the meditation, and we're sort of too concerned to address every little problem that comes up, then that can be more of a problem itself. You end up just being restless and analysing it and thinking, oh, you know, every time you have a thought of ill will, oh, do I need to go and do metta meditation now or something like that? So that can end up being more of a problem than the hindrance itself. So I believe we finished the section on the hindrances, is that right, last week? And the end of the section on hindrances, tasi me pancha nivarane pahine atani samana pasato pamodam jayati pamuditasa piti jayati piti manasakayo pati sambhati patasadhakayo sukhangvedeti sukhino chittam samadhiyati. So, viewing or contemplating the abandoning of those five hindrances within oneself, joy arises. Pamojam jayati. Pamojade. Gladness. Pamuditasa, for one who is joyful, one who is glad. Bhiti jayati. Rapture arises. For one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil, which of course you experience. Did we discuss this particular phrase last week? I don't think we did we? We were talking about the abandoning of hindrances. No, we didn't discuss this particular phrase. Okay, so one who feels rapture, their body becomes tranquil, and one whose body is tranquil experiences bliss, sukha, and one whose mind is blissful goes into concentration, becomes concentrated. So this is talking here, this passage, this is the basic psychology of samadhi, the psychology of meditation, how the mind actually goes into states of concentration. And so the psychology, this is very clear, very straightforward, that our mind is oppressed by the five hindrances. Hence all of the similes for the five hindrances, like a being lost in the desert, or like being in debt, or like being ill, like being in prison, or like being a slave. And when those are abandoned, the mind is happy, just as anybody in those situations, when they get free of those situations, then they would feel happy. And that initial feeling of happiness, of joy at having abandoned the hindrances, of course, is a pamoja. Okay, just a simple word for joy or happiness. Pamuditasa piti jayati. So piti, in a sense, is very similar to pamoja in its meaning, but piti is used in a more specialist sense to speak of the rapture, the sense of uplift which arises in the meditation itself. The rapture. When the mind has rapture in it, then the body becomes tranquil. And of course, we experience this in many ways in meditation. You know, your body just naturally becomes more peaceful and so on. But most obviously in the breath, that the breath itself becomes very peaceful and very subtle. Pasadhakayo sukhang vedeti. When the body is tranquil, one experiences bliss. So this is the sukha. And when the mind is blissful, it goes into samadhi. So this is that process of meditation. Of course, in the suttas, typically, you know, the suttas sort of present things happening one after another. But of course, that's, you know, there is a sequential dimension to it, but it's not completely, you know, it's not that you completely abandon all the five hindrances before you start to feel any kind of joy. On the contrary, that the feelings of joy, if you abandon the hindrances a little bit, then that'll give a little bit of joy, and then that little bit of joy helps you to abandon the hindrances further. and so on. So these things always reinforce each other. But there's a definite, one thing you should be clear about here is that there's, in this sense, that the happiness, thank you very much, that the happiness that's experienced here is a very definite kind of cycle. It's a psychological presence of happiness. It's not the more kind of refined form of happiness that's just the absence of suffering. Okay, so here you have a very definite positive psychological affect, which is that which helps the mind, lead the mind into samadhi. So, move on to the passage dealing with the four jhanas themselves. Just expanded the text a little bit here. So, viviceva kamehi vivica kusalehi dhamehi savitakam savitaram vivekatam piti sukhan patamang jhanam upasampadja viharate. So, the translation, quite secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, unwholesome states, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, unwholesome qualities or something. He enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, again, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, savitatang savicharang, and filled with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Piti sukhang, okay, born of seclusion. So this is, of course, the standard jhana formula found countless times in the texts and found in virtually identical form in every strata of Buddhist texts and every school of Buddhist texts, and in every translation everywhere has essentially exactly the same jhana formula. And this particular version in the Samanipala Sutta, being the kind of the royal discourse, expands the ordinary jhana formula with some very lovely explanations. He drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses his body with this rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of this entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. Great king, suppose a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice were to pour soap powder into a metal basin, sprinkle it with water, and knead it into a ball so that the ball of soap powder was pervaded by moisture, encompassed by moisture, suffused with moisture inside and out, and yet would not trickle. So too, the bhikkhu drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses his body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of his entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. This great king is a visible fruit of the holy life, which is more excellent and sublime than the previous ones. Okay, so at this point, we're starting to actually answer the king's question. If you remember that the king's question right at the beginning was, is there any visible fruit of the holy life? And then the Buddha replies by giving some fairly simple things and saying if somebody was freed and became, was a slave and became freed. And then the king would respect their freedom. So this was a fruit of the holy life, and the samanya, the asceticism. But that wasn't good enough for King Ajatasattu, so the Buddha went on to teach the whole of the gradual training, to teach what are the higher and more sublime fruits of the holy life. And here he finally starts to answer the question directly. This is the first, this is a visible fruit of Buddhahood, more excellent and sublime than the previous ones. So, given that the jhana formula is obviously a matter of great significance and great import in Buddhism, it's worth looking at the text in some detail. So that we're all clear about what it says and what it doesn't say. Okay, so let's just have a look at the text here. Viviceva kamehi, vivicha kusalehi dhamehi. So let's have a look at this phrase. Each phrase has its own importance and its own problems, so let's have a look at them one by one. Notice how these two phrases are parallel, with the difference that this one has viviceva kamehi. So this is captured in the translation by quite secluded. So vivica means secluded, yeah? and whichever is emphatic. So whether it's really meant to apply to that first thing, it's probably just a sort of little quirk of language rather than meaning any difference in meaning between the two. Vivit whichever ka me hi. This is an ablative form, ablative plural form from karma, right? And of course raises the question, what is karma? And here we've come to our first controversy, because of course these things can be interpreted and are frequently interpreted in very different ways. Two meanings of karma. One is the sense objects, okay, and another meaning of karma is sense desire. Okay, so this has two quite distinct possible interpretations here. We could argue that what it means here is that we still experience all of the senses, okay, so we still experience all of the sense objects, but we don't have any desire for them. Alright? So this is one very popular interpretation for viviteva kamehi. In other words, you can be sitting there and you can still hear and feel your body and all of these kinds of things, and yet you're not attracted to them, and you don't have the karma in the sense of the sense desire.
But it's not injustice, it's folly.
Sorry?
It's not injustice, it's folly.
Well, it could mean, that's another possible interpretation. It could mean one, it could mean the other, it could mean both, it could mean neither, according to Indian logic. So, are we left? You know, do we have no recourse here? Do we have no refuge? Do we abandon the search for truth at this point, in the first line of the jhana formula? Or is there anything that we can use that might help us to answer the question?
What was your question?
Uh-huh. The question, two meanings for karma here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Uh-huh.
Means either the sense objects, so sight, sound, smell, taste and touch.
Uh-huh.
Or it means your desire for those objects.
Uh-huh.
So which one does it mean here?
The one with sense
desire. Uh-huh. I have decided to say the one with plural form. Yeah? That's very sense objects. Okay? Yeah. Well, that seems to have that meaning in the next phrase, though, doesn't it? Because secluded from unwholesome dhammas. So, in unwholesome dhammas, obviously, that would include desire and hatred and hindrances and all of those things. So it seems to have that meaning there.
So the word secluded,
mm-hmm.
It's not just sitting alone.
Well, in a sense, no. Yeah. So, okay.
Secluded in your mind.
Secluded in your mind, yeah. It is used in that sense. It's used, the word for seclusion is, typically has three kaya, viveka, chitta, viveka, pandi, viveka. There's this, doctrinally, there's these three kinds of seclusion which are recognized as just a different form of the word here. But kaya viveka, bodily seclusion, when you go away to your hut in the middle of the forest. Chitta viveka is a word for the four jhanas. And upadhi viveka is seclusion from the fundamental levels of the defilements. So this is the word for the arahant. So this is three kinds of seclusion recognized in Buddhism. So karma, sense objects, plural form. So we've got a grammatical suggestion there. So that's interesting. That gives us, that's nice and objective sounding. Is there any another suggestion, Venerable suggested, looking in the context? Unfortunately, in this particular case, as it happens, context isn't necessarily going to help us a huge amount, but the grammatical consideration is, I believe, decisive. Recently, just talking with Venerable Brahmali about this as well. And basically, the situation is, of course, these two things are quite grammatically distinct. I mean, you have sense objects always present a plurality to you. You have sight, sound, smell, taste, and touches. And whenever sense karma is used in that sense, it's always used in a plural. But desire, you know, when you talk about, say, desire as the first one of the five hindrances, for example, karma chanda, it's always in a singular. Right? So the actual internal desire for the senses and so on is always a singular form. And here we have the plural form, viyujeva kamehi. So it seems to me that that's quite decisive and quite clear in the meaning that it must be the sense objects. There are other considerations there as well, but that to me is perhaps the most straightforward. So I take this as referring to sense objects disappearing. One of the other reasons for interpreting it that way is because in here, vivicha akusalehi dhamehi, obviously that includes sensual desire. So the text is either redundant in repeating sensual desire, which is possible. It maybe could be argued it simply does that because it's such an important hindrance. So that's fair enough. Doesn't make it impossible. But certainly, it's definitely included. And then in that case, akusalehi dhamehi would basically just be a shorthand for the five hindrances, really.
So that's how you see desire. That's too similar to it, can't it?
Yeah.
Has it already been included in the...
Yeah.
It's already been subdued?
Yeah.
So you also include that, it seems to us, already been subdued.
No, not necessarily, no. See, because this is... we'll find that quite a few times through the formulas that these things happen at maybe different points in time, or here it can be, again, it could be said it's by way of emphasis. So there's a difference between leaving behind something, you know. So, you know, at any one moment in your mind, you may or may not have sense desire, but here it's like you're completely secluded from it. So, that's not necessarily a decisive consideration. But there are other passages, which I won't go into in detail here, but that suggests that when you know, in jhana, then you don't hear anything and so on. So anyway, this is my interpretation of it, is that this means, vivicheva kamehi means secluded from all objects of senses, i.e. No sense experience. Okay, during the jhana, that's really one of the signals, the first stage signaling, first jhana. It makes a big difference, and a lot of jhana teachers teach the other interpretation of it, and obviously you're talking about a much looser and probably shallower state of mind, where you can still experience things.
When you talk about seclusion from objects or senses, do you also mean mental objects, or just the five?
It would mean, if it's karma, if the meaning is the object of senses, in that case it would only be the sight, sound, smell, taste and touches. It always talks about the pancha karma gune, the five strands of sensual pleasures. But of course then there's still thoughts and memories and so on, sense desire, which would come under the second phrase, akusala dhammas. So there was no unwholesome dhammas in the mind either.
So does that mean there's no sense input?
That's right, yeah.
In the
first jhana. No sight, sound, smell, taste and touch.
And that ends on its own, or we should...
If you're practicing, especially for a beginner, it basically happens when it does. If you've got mastery over it, then you can determine it beforehand. You can't determine it while you're in there, but you can say beforehand, you know, I want to go into this attainment for half an hour or for 2 hours or something like that, and then just do it. Yeah. Which is actually sounds like it's quite amazing or something, but it's actually not that hard to do. I mean, you can do it even with things like sleeping or things. You can just say, you know, I'm going to wake up at such and such a time, and you actually have an internal clock which gets you out of it. So it's not actually such a remarkable thing, but that's just when you've got a bit of control over it and it's a bit predictable.
Is secluded from sense objects and unwholesome space. Is it a prerequisite for the first jhana, or is it a quality within the first jhana?
Well, I think it's, you know, you're basically abandoning them all the way along through the meditation, and then at the entry to jhana that they've gone really concluded, really completely, so that that's why I think the vichava phrase is like you're completely separated from them, rather than being that they just simply don't happen to be arising at this moment, you know. Before jhana, yeah, of course the mind is developing wholesome states for a long time before that, but it's not as solid and decisive.
Sometimes you just don't hear things.
Right.
Because various reasons. Because it's not that your ear didn't hear
right.
Messages in your brain, your stuff isn't
right.
But that for some reason you didn't perceive that.
Yeah, that's right.
Now is it that the auditory process the visual process is totally not working,
Or is it that there's
some sensory perceptive mechanism?
It's hard to say. I mean, the main thing is that the description is always from a subjective point of view.
Yeah.
So it's from the meditator's point of view, there's simply no hearing, for example. To what extent that means that the ear itself is not working or whatever, it's a bit hard to say subjectively. I mean, there are various stories that you hear about that, but that would be something which could be testable, I would guess. You know, you could get someone in jhana and then test their different responses to sense activities and things.
Because you can see, there might be the other thing I've also heard, hearing is very sensitive, and even if you're in jhana.
And it can pull you out. So, these guys, savitakam, savicharam. So, savitaka, savichara. So, they translate it various ways, but sa is with. And vitaka is the normal word for thought in Pali. And so vichara, with, and vichara means exploring or examining. So of course you get many different translations of these, and initial and sustained thought and various kinds of things that are used. And of course there's being another controversial matter about whether you're actually allowed to, whether you can think in jhana. And of course again it makes quite a big difference in terms of what kind of state of samadhi that you're talking about. I mean you can have fairly, you know, there's no great attainment to be able to sit there in a state of meditation and not have thoughts for a while. One would wonder how you could, possibly call something a superhuman quality worthy of the attainment of the noble ones, and you're sitting there thinking about this and that while you're in your jhana. But what exactly does it mean? The first thing to remember, of course, is that we are talking about what the Buddha called the higher mind, the adhijitta, the superhuman dhammas, the exalted and refined fruits of the holy life, and all of these kinds of things. So the Buddha used a very high praise for these attainments. And so there's no doubt that what we're dealing with is a state of consciousness which is quite refined, which is transformed, where the ordinary qualities that we experience in that are not the same as in ordinary consciousness. So, for example, you know, we talk about bliss, the bliss of samadhi. Well, obviously, the thing which is being talked about when we use the word sukha in jhana is quite a different kind of thing than the thing we call sukha or pleasure in, you know, the pleasure of eating a meal or something like that. I mean, they're quite very, very different kinds of things, but we have to use the same word for it simply because our language, both in the language of the suttas and also in our contemporary language, has been evolved in talking about ordinary everyday contexts. Yeah, we understand those. We understand if we say to somebody else, I had a nice meal, that was tasty, I enjoyed it, then we both know what that means, and so we can develop a common language with that. Whereas the language of meditation, and especially these profound states of meditation, is not something which can be developed in a community so easily. And so we draw on the ordinary language and we apply it in a new context, which of course is what you always have to do when you're talking about anything in a refined way. You develop a specialized technical vocabulary in any kind of specialized field of study. So it's not at all unreasonable to suppose that the meaning of vitaka vichara here, you know, may be developed or may be different from the ordinary everyday language meaning. And so that more developed meaning is usually understood. Vitaka is something like application or applying the mind. Application, don't appeal to me. Application and vichara are something like holding the mind, holding something like that, or sustaining perhaps there. These are the two kind of possible explanations here, and again there are a number of different contexts and so on which can be brought in to argue for one or the other, but for example one of the most decisive contexts it seems to me is in where this particular issue is specifically discussed. And remember, as a principle when we're studying the suttas, that it's best not to rely on kind of vague or uncertain inferences where something just happens to seem to mean that way because it was a side effect of a story which is being discussed. We should, to decide important points, we should go to those places in the suttas where the Buddha actually directly addressed the point that we're discussing and to see what he has to say in that context. And in this context where the Buddha actually talked about this was called the Dvaidaha Vitaka Sutta. And so it's a sutta about vitaka, and it's about this specific issue. How do you develop thought in the path of practice? And so in that Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, the Buddha starts out by dividing up thoughts into good thoughts and bad thoughts. And so here he's developing the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Sammasankappa. And so he realizes that by developing the wholesome thoughts, he can keep on thinking like that, day in and day out, without causing any harm to anybody. Yeah? There's nothing unwholesome and nothing dangerous about continuing to think those wholesome thoughts. But, he says, the sutta says, if I keep on thinking and keep on exploring anuvitaketi, anuvichareti, then my mind will never go to peace. I'll never find unification of mind. So he says, well, what if I abandon this vitaka and vichara? And then he says, abandoning vitaka, secluded from vitaka, secluded from vichara, he enters into the first jhana. Secluded from karma, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, with vitaka and with vichara, he enters the first jhana. In other words, he says, I've got to abandon this thinking that I'm doing and then go to peace of mind, and the peace of mind, it says, savitaka, savichara, with vitaka, with vichara. So in that context, it very clearly suggests that vitaka and vichara don't mean thinking, and that when they're used in the context of jhanas, that they mean something that's much more subtle than thinking. So how this is usually explained, and how it's explained in the commentaries and also the teachings of Ajahn Brahm and others, is that The vikaka is the initial act of applying one's mind to the meditation object, and the vichara is the sustaining or keeping the mind with the meditation object. So it's like a twofold sort of applying and then holding, and then keeping on reapplying and holding. So it's more talking about a much more fundamental and much more subtle kind of residual movement of the mind onto the meditation object, happening at a kind of automatic level, rather than at a rather than the sort of thinking about things.
So it's something that's not, you can't sort of make the decision, oh right, I'm done now, I better do this.
That's right. Happens. That's right, yeah. It happens intuitively, and once you're there you're lost. Again, that's in an ordinary state of consciousness, but by this we're not talking about an ordinary state of consciousness. Yeah, we're talking about the higher mind. So it's at that higher mind, because there's no hindrances, then there's nothing obstructing, there's nothing distracting, there's nothing moving you away from that. So that's why normally we have to keep making an effort, isn't it? Because the things are getting in our way. Yeah? So once you're in the jhana, there's nothing getting in your way anymore. It is. It is, yeah, it's the same root, yeah, so you could translate it as wandering. So you could say, one enters the first jhana, thinking and wandering. Hey, I've been doing that much better, sorry? Oh, yeah. In that sense, yes, that could be, again, etymologically, yeah, the wandering mind.
Speaking of self as an individual is that sort of go to the phone, pushing one more.
Yeah.
So, what's your confession of? I think that's something. I think that's
good. Okay, so I'd like to. Oh, no, if we finish off the first jhana form to start with. Viveka jhang, bhiti sukhang. So, viveka jhang is born of seclusion. Okay, so the word viveka is the same word we've had before, seclusion, with the ending, the ja ending just meaning born of seclusion, born of seclusion, piti sukha, so rapture bliss, okay, we usually translate it rapture and bliss, born of seclusion. And so the seclusion here, obviously being the seclusion from the sense objects and the unwholesome dhammas, which have given rise to the piti sukha, the rapture and bliss. So it's the fact that we've now completely left behind that sense sphere world with all of its stresses and strains and difficulties and so on. And so that in itself gives rise to bliss, which is, of course, what we've seen in that initial process leading into jhana in the first place. Patamang jhana, first jhana, upasampadya viharati. Patamang is just first, and the word jhana, dhi, the original jhana, the original root of jhana is dhi, and it was, it's in the Sanskrit, you can see that root more easily, dhyana. Of course, in China is chan, in Japan is zen, Korean son. Thai is chan as well. What is it in Tibetan? What do they say in Tibetan?
Concentration?
Jhana, specifically.
Jhana.
Mm.
We don't talk about jhana as much.
There must be a word for it in Tibetan.
Sure there is.
Yeah, Zen. What do they have in Vietnamese? Is chan, sen, son. I remember you can go to Vietnamese as well. Anyway, so the etymologically, yes, the root originally is D, which was one of the, it's used very commonly in the Rig Vedas as the like the ecstatic sort of visioning of the Vedic verses. So when the Vedic poets would, we were talking about this the other day, and the Vedic poets would get into kind of a state of trance or whatever, a shamanic thing, or and they're kind of receiving or transmitting these verses, and through this kind of ecstatic visioning of the truth that's revealed to them by the gods, then one of the words which is used for this is dhi, and this has evolved through time to become the used in Pali for jhana. Of course, the root jhana or jayati is used much more widely than the four jhanas themselves. It's used in a number of different contexts, but of course the most important one is the four jhanas. But especially if you put a prefix before it, pajhayati, nijhayati, and so on, then you get words that mean something like to ponder or brood. So this is what, say, the Bodhisattva did when he came home after seeing the four sights, and he came home to the palace and he brooded about them all. It was one of these words, I can't remember exactly one, I think nijayati or pajayati or something. Okay, so it's a similar, it's a kind of idea of kind of almost kind of obsessing about something, not being able to stop thinking about it and so on. So in that case, it's a more of an ordinary, everyday language version of it, and jhana having the more specific meaning. Of course, it's often understood, normally understood, that that the jhanas are pre-Buddhist practices, although it's not, they're not sort of found enumerated and described clearly in pre-Buddhist practice, but we do find, say, in Mahabharata and later Hindu texts, the formulas for the first jhana and things which are obviously influenced by Buddhism. Is it what, sir? Really? Dhi. I'm not sure if it's the same word or not. So I would like to look at some of the things that the Visuddhimagga has to say about jhana, if I may. And let's see if they have anything to add to this. Well, I know they have a lot to add to it. Now, the just as a kind of word of explanation, if you're not familiar with the Visuddhimagga, the way that it goes about things is it goes on, it talks about sila, and then talks about developing concentration, and it uses as its first example of developing concentration the development of the earth kasina, the Patavi kasina. So it basically talks about a monk who's developing the earth kasina. And even though this is a fairly minor practice in the suttas, but because of this, it becomes much more significant in the Visuddhimagga's discussion, whether this is merely by chance. Actually, the earth kasina first appears at the beginning of a list of meditation objects in the, I think, in the Dhammasangani, in Pali Abhidhamma. So it enumerates the various kinds of meditation objects, the 40 meditation subjects, and so on. But then its basic discussion is all in the context of someone developing the earth kasina. And so that it's in that context that the discussion on the jhanas and so on takes place, and then goes on to the detailed discussion of other meditation objects afterwards. So, let's have a look at some of the things it says. So it says that the first jhana abandons five factors, possesses five factors, is good in three ways, possesses 10 characteristics, and is of the earth kasina. So the five factors are abandoned, of course, the five hindrances. The five factors possessed are the five jhana factors, and the is good in three ways. I'm not quite sure what the good is three ways is. And it possesses 10 characteristics. And again, I'm not quite sure what those 10 characteristics are. So, the three, goodness in three ways is in the beginning, middle, and end. Okay. And the possession of 10 characteristics should be understood as the characteristics of the beginning, middle, and end too. Okay, so anyway, it goes on to describe why that is so in some detail. Anyway, so here's the Visuddhimagga's discussion of the formula of the first jhana, remembering that the Visuddhimagga is the centerpiece of the commentarial system, so that in here we find the basic commentarial description of these things, which may be elaborated in various other places, but most of the time when the formulas for the four jhanas and so on appear in the suttas, I'll discuss them very briefly, as in the commentary to the Samanyapada Sutta itself. And the reader is referred to the Visuddhimagga. Okay, so the phrase viviccheva kamehi is quite secluded from sense pleasures, means having gone away from, become quite without. The word eva means in the sense of absoluteness. Okay, when absoluteness is introduced thus, what is expressed is that sense desires are certainly incompatible with this jhana. When they exist, it does not occur, just as when there is darkness, there is no light, and it is only when letting go of them that it's reached, just as the further bank is reached by letting go of the near bank. Here it might be asked, why is this word quite, ever, mentioned in the first phrase and not in the second? Vivicca akusalehi damehi. How is this? Could he enter and dwell on the first jhana even when not completely secluded from unwholesome dhammas? Is the question it's asked. It should not be regarded in that way. It's mentioned in the first phrase as the escape from them, for this jhana is the escape from sense desire, since it surmounts the sense desire element and is incompatible with the greed for sense desires, according as it is said, the escape from sense desires is this, that is to say, renunciation. Remembering that in this translation, Nyanamoli is simply translating karma as sense desires, so it's not meaning that's just his translation. And in the second phrase, the word eva should be adduced, so it should be inferred. For it's impossible to enter and dwell in the jhana unsecluded, also from unprofitable things. That is to say, the hindrances. So this word must be read in both phrases thus, quite secluded from sensuality, quite secluded from unwholesome things. Though the word secluded is a general term, includes all signs of seclusion. Blah, blah, blah. So, okay, and then it goes on to discuss this question that we talked about the meaning of karma here. This term sense desires karma should be regarded as including all kinds. That is to say, sense desires object given in the Nidesa, in the passage beginning, some Nidesa being one of the earlier commentarial works found in the canon itself, in the Nidesa, in the passage beginning, what are the sense desires as object? They are agreeable, visible objects and so on. And the sense desires as defilement are given there too, and in the Vibhanga, thus, the Vibhanga being the Abhidhamma book, zeal is sense desire, greed is sense desire, and so on, thinking is sense desire, and so on and so forth. That being so, the words quite secluded from sense desires properly mean quite secluded from sense desires as object, and express bodily seclusion, while the words secluded from unprofitable things properly mean secluded from sense desires as defilement, or from all unprofitable things, and express mental seclusion. And this case of giving up pleasure in sense desires is indicated by the first, since it only expresses seclusion from sense desires as object, while the acquisition of pleasure in renunciation is indicated by the second, since it expresses seclusion from sense desire as defilement. Okay, so here he's answered that question, or given an answer to the question, saying that the sense desires, one is secluded both from the sense desires as object, the senses as object, as well as from the defilement. And as usual, it goes on to talk about the various kinds of other readings for it, which I won't go into. Okay, so then he goes on to talk about the factors developed by the first jhana, which is the vitakka vichara. So here vitakka is applied thought, is vitakka. Hitting upon is what is meant. It has a characteristic of directing the mind onto an object or mounting the mind on its object. Its function is to strike at and thresh. For the meditator is said, in virtue of it, to have the object struck at by applied thought, by vitakka, threshed by vitakka. This sounds slightly violent kind of thing, but it's what do you do when you're threshing wheat or something like that? You're sort of constantly going over and over and going to kind of refine it.
Yeah, no,
they're
finding most of them
have
usually carrots or something.
Uh-huh. There'd be a repeated.
Yeah.
There'd be a repeated thing. When you don't use a stick or something.
Thresh, that's grinding. Threshing is when you're taking grain.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what you hit it with. Stuff.
Usually it's some sort of animal, and they walk round and round, and it loosens the grain from. You see it in the yoga, especially the stick. No, that's for breaking down the grain.
Here we go. Here we've got some threshing.
To separate the seed from the.
Threshing wheat near Iraq, Iran.
They're using donkeys there.
Yeah, the donkeys walking around.
They've got some weight sitting on something that's squashing.
Yeah, well, he's, in a sense, it's interesting that because they're moving and it's also it's controlling and it's keeping it within the area, isn't it? Yeah? It's not just a random movement. Fire sermons, or farm sermons. The Spurgeon archive, whatever this is. Threshing. No, but here they're definitely hitting. Here they're hitting in this one, but then they've got the things going round in this one. It's interesting, isn't it?
They're winnowing as well.
Yeah, so this definitely has that idea of sort of going around. Process of loosening the edible part of the cereal grain or other crop. Animal powered thresher. It may be done by beating the grain using a flail on a threshing floor. Another traditional method of threshing is to make donkeys or oxen walk in circles on the grain on a hard surface. A modern version of this is to spread the grain on the surface of the country roads so it can be threshed by the wheels of passing cars.
Threshing the grain means removing all the discursive thoughts and coming to focus on the objects of meditation. Is that what we mean by threshing the mind?
Well, there you go, there's a thresh thing. I can't get it there full screen.
Yeah. But you see those things are sort of, they're loose.
Interesting. Yeah. The point of breach is to get rid of all of the all of the new rules, that's going to be done, but I'm going to say that all of the obstructions.
So it's continually. So let's say
I did it in Nepal.
You did it in Nepal?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
They did it on the road after the woman had beat it.
So you beat it first, yeah? I mean, it could well mean that what it says is ahana pariyahana ma, striking and threshing. It sounds to me it's more like a striking kind of thing, but it's probably, it's not, obviously not.
Well, we'll have to find out how they do it in Sri Lanka. Rice.
So it's continuing.
How do they get the tradition? How do they get the rice out? They bend the rice. Oh, okay.
Like that?
No, okay.
They get the actual rice. Okay.
Look up rice expression. Because if it's Sri Lanka, they might, either Sri Lanka, they might be, that might be their example.
A glimpse of the past.
You know, rice, they don't have wheat in Sri Lanka. What rice could have soft rice?
Anyway, there's a glimpse of the past for everybody.
I remember in Sri Lanka, actually, the word for threshing is used at school.
Mm-hmm.
If you're learning yourself,
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So you go over it and over it. Okay. Yeah. Even working over it. Yeah. No, it's got a much more basic meaning here. It doesn't actually talk about that. Yeah, it's
something that has to be done over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, just go and then go on. Yeah.
So I'll just read the full passage here. Its function is to strike at and thresh, for the meditator is said in virtue of it to have the object struck at by applied thought, threshed by applied thought, is manifested as the leading of the mind onto an object. Vichara. It means continued sustainment. So that the explanation here of vichara is anusanjana, which is just a etymologically similar word, but it has this, the prefix anu means along with, continued. It has the characteristic of continued pressure on or occupation with the object. Its function is to keep conascent mental states occupied with that. Conascent mental states just means the mental qualities that are occurring at the same time. It is manifested as keeping consciousness anchored on that object. And though sometimes not separate, applied thought is the first compact of the mind in the sense that it is both gross and inceptive, like the striking of a bell. Sustained thought is the act of keeping the mind anchored in the sense that it is subtle with the individual essence of continued pressure, so with the nature of continued pressure like the ringing of the bell. Okay, so vitaka is like hitting the bell, the initial striking of the bell, and then vichara is like the ringing of the bell. Applied thought intervenes, vitaka intervenes, being the interference of consciousness at the time of first arousing, like a bird spreading out its wings when about to soar into the air, and like a bee's diving towards a lotus when it wants to follow up the scent of it. The behavior of vichara is quiet, being the near non-interference of consciousness, like the birds gliding with outspread wings after soaring into the air, and like the bees buzzing above the lotus after it has dived towards it. Okay? In the commentary to the Book of Twos, the Anguttara Nikaya, it says this. So here, this is an interesting one where Buddha goes through is actually referring from the Visuddhimagga to the commentary on the Anguttara Twos. More normally, it happens the other way around. This is said, vitaka occurs as the state of directing the mind onto an object, like the movement of a large bird taking off into the air by engaging the air with both wings and forcing them downwards, for it causes absorption by being unified. And there's a footnote here that these sentences are not found in the Burmese and Harvard editions. Sustained thought occurs with the nature of continued pressure, like a bird's movement when it is using its wings for the purpose of keeping hold in the air, for it keeps pressing the object. That fits with the latter's occurrence, vichara's occurrence as anchoring. The difference between them becomes evident in the first and second jhanas, that is, in the fivefold reckoning of jhanas in the Abhidhamma. There's a few, normally in the four jhanas, the vitaka and vichara are said to be abandoned together. So the first jhana has vitaka vichara, and the second jhana doesn't have vitaka vichara. There's a few places in the suttas where the Buddha talks about developing samadhi, that is savitaka savichara, that is avitaka, but savichara, and then samadhi, which is avitaka and avichara. So with both vitaka and vichara, or with vichara but without vitaka, and without both. So there seems to be this kind of in-between state, which is not quite captured in the scheme of the four jhanas. So the Abhidhamma, with their emphasis on classifying everything, sort of talk about the five jhanas, the second jhana in their scheme being with vichara but without vitaka. Furthermore, applied thought, vitaka is like the hand that grips firmly, and vichara is like the hand that rubs. When one grips a tarnished metal dish firmly with one hand and rubs it with powder and oil and a woolen pad with the other hand. Likewise, when a potter has spun his wheel with a stroke on the stick and is making a dish, His supporting hand is like vitaka, and the hand that moves back and forth is like vichara. Likewise, when one is drawing a circle, the pin that stays fixed down in the center is like vitaka, which directs onto the object, and the pin which revolves around it is like vichara, which continually presses. So that's interesting that that last one would connect with that idea of threshing as the animal's going around the center, yeah, around in the circle, whereas the other descriptions is like the threshing is being striking, but it seems that both of them can apply here. So this jhana occurs together with this vitaka and vichara, and it is accompanied with them as a tree is called, accompanied by flowers and fruits. Okay, so that's the discussion of vitaka vichara.
Before you get to jhana, when you're using vitaka vichara in the mundane sense,
yeah.
So you have an object, a breath,
yeah.
You apply your mind to it, and when the mind lands on the object, then you let go of vitaka and you just operate in vichara.
Mm.
And then when it slips off, then you do vitaka again, and then vichara, mm. And so on.
Yeah. Except, I mean, I would say that when... especially early in the meditation that when you're using, say, a counting method or buddho or whatever, or maybe just applying your mind to the breath, but you're doing that more on a regular basis, it's more like you assume that the mind is probably going to slip away. So you sort of keep on just replacing it, and as you keep on doing that, as time gradually goes on, the vichara becomes stronger and it tends to sort of stay there more naturally. Yeah.
The examples you just quoted, they seem to imply that, like a compass,
mm-hmm.
the point and the circle, they're both working together simultaneously.
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah.
So when does that happen? At the beginning or more?
I think they're always there, but, you know, I mean, in a sense, you know, it's just a way of, they're just words that you use to try to understand what's happening in the meditation process, yeah? So in a sense, they're always there, but, you know, like... I think one of the meanings of ekagata is that as the meditation continues, everything sort of comes together and is in balance. So in the early stages, then they may be both there, but they're not in balance or not working perfectly together.
Here's an important question. But is this samatha and samvichara things which conduce to jhana, or the conditions of the jhana, which actually are just pointing to root approaches?
No, I think that they're there because it relates to this idea of the viveka jhana, that the bliss of the jhana is because of its seclusion, and so because it's sort of next door to the sense realm, so this is why they sort of needed to sort of keep on holding it back, yeah. So, but then when the mind gets more confidence, it's the second jhana, and it doesn't feel so nervous about it. I'm using nervousness again in a fairly exalted state here, but. Then that says ajatan sampasaranam, the internal confidence, and then there's no need for the vitaka vichara anymore.
This is a question that I asked just now about vitaka vichara, vitaka needing effort, because the example that you gave just now from the
Vissarima,
that seems to imply that effort needs to be there for vitaka first before you can sustain the vichara.
Different examples would imply that differently. So in some it says holding a dish with one hand and rubbing it with another. So in that case they work together, and then in other cases like the bird that flaps its wings and then glides,
yeah,
then they're separate.
So that moves to Bhante's statement just now that, you know, when you lose your vichara, then go back to vitaka again, and then you hold it again, and then someone stop again, and you go back. So within this period of vitaka and vichara, I don't think there will be any piti or sukha or happening. When you are actually swinging between vitaka and vichara, so that I don't think when you are actually working between vitaka and vichara, there will come piti or sukha.
Oh, coincidence.
Not able to hold it there simultaneously, or at least to dwell.
No. What you're describing there is just much more like a state of trying to get the meditation together. But this is not talking about anything like that. It's not like you're swinging between one or the other. talking about a state of one-pointedness, where these factors which are present in ordinary consciousness have become refined and sublimated and transformed, and so that their application onto to the object is happening, you know, completely smoothly and completely automatically, and so it's just like the kind of the gentle washing of the waves onto the beach or something like that. There's nothing. It's not like you're sitting there exerting yourself and trying to make yourself be one with the meditation object.
Actually, my question is Vitakka and Vichara a prerequisite for the first jhana, or it is together with the five qualities that comes after you have already succeeded?
No, all of the factors are things you develop a long, long time before you. That's what you sit down and you meditate. You sit down and you apply yourself onto your meditation object, the very first thing that you do. The very first thing that you do when you sit to meditate, what's the first thing that you're trying to do?
Vitakka.
Exactly.
No, that's exactly why I asked you the question. Vitakka doesn't come naturally in its effort. But then, of course, when it comes to like the qualities of this jhana, it seems that Vitakka and Vichara doesn't need any effort.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm confused over this.
Well, don't be confused. There's nothing unusual about it. If I want to learn the piano, when I first sit down to learn it, it's a big effort, and I have to go every finger, I have to worry about. Once I've learned it as well as Catherine has, I just sit down there and the music just comes out.
Yeah, yeah, but then that is...
There's no effort.
Yeah, so she doesn't really need to actually apply too much effort into sustaining that focus where she already knows.
That's right.
Yeah, so she... Yeah. No, it's okay.
The process just happens.
Yeah. So there's nothing mysterious about it, there's nothing unusual, it's just like anything else that we do.
Yeah, I know.
If you see somebody who's a master at their craft, they become one with it, and it just goes.
I understand about the initial Vitakka and Vichara thing, but when you mentioned that Vitakka and Vichara comes together with Piti and Sukha and that is the confusion there. But it's okay, but
the
one
is
the experience
in order to know. Alright, keep on going. If we can just clear up a few things, then that's good. Alright. So, let's move on to the, Vivekajang, the explanation of Vivekajang. It says seclusion, disappearance of the hindrances, blah, blah, that's all, didn't say much. Okay, happiness and bliss. Okey-dokey. So here we have the description of Piti Sukha. It refreshes Vinayati, thus it is happiness. Sukha. Piti. Okay. It is a characteristic of endearing. Its function is to refresh the body and the mind, or its function is to pervade and thrill with rapture. It is manifested as elation. But it can be classed as five kinds, as minor happiness, momentary happiness, showering rapture, uplifting rapture, and pervading rapture. Herein, minor rapture is only able to raise the hairs of the body. Okay? So you have a bit of a zoo, and the hairs go up in your body, then that's minor piti, kuddaka piti. Momentary rapture is like flashes of lightning at different moments. Okay? Showering rapture breaks over the body again and again, like waves on the seashore. So these are all very common experiences for meditators. And so you can see that those ones are still not particularly, useful for samadhi. You know, you can have showering rapture, which feels very nice and so on, but it's not peaceful. And goes on to uplifting rapture can be powerful enough to levitate the body and make it spring up into the air. For this is what happened to the elder Mahatissa, resident at Purnavalika. He went to the shrine terrace on the evening of the full moon day. Seeing the moonlight, he faced in the direction of the great shrine at Anuradhapura, thinking, at this very hour, the four assemblies, including the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis and so on, are worshipping at the great shrine by means of objects formerly seen there, by remembering what his formerly seeing great shrine, he aroused uplifting rapture with the Buddha as his object, and he rose into the air like a painted ball bounced off a plastered floor and alighted in the terrace of the great shrine. It must have been a great occasion for the thing. Everyone's going down there doing the word puja and chanting at night time, and this sort of monk flies through the air. Terrific. And this is what happened to the daughter of a family in the village of Vatakalaka near the Girikandika monastery. When she sprang up into the air owing to strong uplifting rapture with the Buddha as an object. As her parents were about to go to the monastery in the evening, so it seems, in order to hear the Dhamma, they told her, "My dear, you are expecting a child. You cannot go out at an unsuitable time. We shall hear the Dhamma and gain merit for you." Interesting concept there. So they went out. And though she wanted to go too, she could not well object to what they said. She stepped out of the house onto a balcony and stood looking at the Akasa Chetiya shrine at the Girikandika, lit by the moon. She saw the offering of lamps at the shrine and the four communities as they circumambulated it to the right after making their offering of flowers and perfumes. And she heard the sound of the mass chanting by the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Then she thought, how lucky they are to be able to go to the monastery and wander around such a shrine terrace and listen to such sweet preaching of the Dhamma. Seeing the shrine as a mound of pearls and arousing uplifting happiness, she sprang up into the air, and before her parents arrived, she came down from the air into the shrine terrace where she paid homage and stood listening to the Dhamma. When her parents arrived, they asked her, "What road did you come by?" She said, "I came through the air, not by the road." And when they told her, "My dear, but only the arahants come through the air, but how did you come?" She replied, "As I was standing looking at the shrine in the moonlight, a strong sense of happiness arose in me with the Buddha as its object. Then I knew no more whether I was standing or sitting, but only that I was springing up into the air with the sign that I had grasped, and I came to rest on this shrine terrace." So uplifting happiness can be powerful enough to levitate the body and make it spring up into the air. But when pervading rapture arises, the whole body is completely pervaded like a filled bladder, like a rock cavern invaded by a huge inundation. Now this, okay, so this is the commentary description of piti. Okay, so as a contemporary example of this piti, double rainbow, this is a famous meme on YouTube. I'm just trying to find the original one. He's actually fallen over onto the ground. He actually falls over with the intensity of it and eyes are coming.
Oh my god!
Million views. 3.5 million views on that one. So, yeah, this is the double rainbow man. So this is perhaps the uplifting deity. But it's interesting because when you read about this kind of emotional response that this laywoman's having to thinking about the shrine, no, but in the Visuddhi Magga, thinking about the shrine and stuff like that, that's tears and everything.
I mean, it's in the Dhamma, when
you
have that kind of pity, is different from this kind. You know, that kind of happiness. Sometimes you go to a monastery and you experience that kind of happiness. It's totally different from what I see.
Because you're going alive, and you say it, and they kind of push you, so you can only say it for a little time. So they would say it, and then come and running, screaming back to say it again. And
really?
Yeah. And they lost their...
but take it to not the pity and jhana, I totally disagree.
Yeah,
I'll send him the link for the Double Rainbow Man. I'll get him to watch it and I'll ask him, is this the same as the Reps of PP and John? he's not in the monastery, but at the retreat centre, yeah. They should go to Double Rainbow Grove. So that's rapture. So this is what I want you all to do during the rain retreat: is get out there, when you see the rainbows, roll around on the ground.
You kind of get to see lots of double rainbows.
You just become so cynical, Aya. Ah, another bloody double rainbow. Well, I'm glad for his sake that he's not living there. He may be able to get any work done. Oh my rapture, oh my good one. Anyway, I think we can agree that perhaps a slightly more coarse form of jhana than what we expected to do.
Does the usual call it aesthetic or what is that? Somebody who is totally overwhelmed by God, that's not done. That's just
it's infectious, isn't it?
Oh no, okay.
Okay, everyone's all right now. We can proceed. So, back to Pali etymology. We just want to sort of bring our mood down a little bit. Nothing better than discussing some etymological derivations. So there's some the thing on rapture, and then. Piti, the next element there is sukha. Piti sukhang. And it says here, okay, so before we go on to that, okay. Oh, here's an important statement here in the Visuddhimagga. Now this fivefold rapture, when conceived and matured, perfects the twofold equanimity, that is bodily and mental. The twofold tranquility, that is bodily and mental tranquility. When tranquility is born and matured, it perfects the twofold sukha, that is bodily and mental bliss. When bliss is born and matured, it perfects the threefold concentration, that is kanika samadhi, momentary concentration, access concentration, and absorption concentration. Now, just to come back to explain this, to come back to the sutta, okay, here he's obviously giving an explanation of this passage here, Pramodam Jayati, Pramodita Piti Jayati. Okay, so one who has gladness and rapture arises, then from rapture to tranquility, from tranquility to sukha, from sukha to samadhi. So here Buddha Gosa's explaining that same sequence, but giving some more details and filling it out to, in accordance with the commentarial system. Now the fivefold rapture, according to the commentaries, includes the Paramoja. So Paramoja is really regarded as being one of the immature or preliminary forms of rapture, according to the commentarial explanation, which seems reasonable enough. And then...
It's not what the rainbow meant.
Well, yeah, he had more on the Paramoja side, yeah? Not fully matured into the tranquility, exactly. So... this is what he needed to look at this one. Piti manasa kayo pasambati. Yeah? For one with rapture, then the body becomes tranquil. But having said which, it's not at all uncommon for meditators to have emotional reactions like that. Crying out in joy, crying, rolling on the floor, and all of these kinds of things. And these are all just immature forms of piti, which have not yet matured into tranquility. And then, so the commentary just sort of fills these ones out. It mentions the fivefold rapture, it mentions the twofold tranquility of body and mind, the twofold bliss of body and mind. So in that sense, it's fairly straightforward, but it's more controversial in that it introduces here the threefold concentration of momentary concentration, access concentration, and absorption concentration, as according to Nyanamoli's translation. So of course, first thing to notice is that this is quite different from what the text itself is saying. The text says, when your mind is blissful, you go into samadhi, and then it explains that samadhi by the four jhanas only. As always, there's no variations in this. So the different kinds of concentration that it mentions here in the commentarial system, and kanika samadhi, upachara samadhi, and apana samadhi, or absorption. Kanika translated as momentary, but momentary is a little bit, doesn't give quite the right idea. The word kana has a technical meaning of a moment, okay? So it means, you know, it's really the smallest time that you can, that time can be divided up to. But actually, more normally, kanika means temporary or short term. So, for example, if you have a one night stand, okay, is called a kanika relationship. Okay, so it means why it's just a temporary or short-term relationship. Doesn't mean it's necessarily momentary. Okay, so this is Kanika Samadhi. Upachara Samadhi is access, and the word upachara literally means the threshold. Okay, so it means the upachara for this room literally is that balcony out there. That's the upachara for the room. Okay, so it's just to mention this, because it's sometimes translated as neighborhood or access. Yeah, neighborhood. I'm just hitting keys randomly here. My usual typing method is just hitting random until I get the right one eventually. So an access, there's quite different things, right? So an access, you could say an access to this room is the driveway, okay? And all the way down here is an access to the room, right? Or the neighborhood, well, you know, the house on the corner is in our neighborhood, right? Yeah? So that's the neighborhood, but that's not really what upachara means. Upachara means the threshold. It means literally, in building terms, it's that the front porch just outside the door is the threshold. So this is why I prefer the translation threshold for upachara samadhi, and apana meaning absorption. And okay. You try doing it. Does anyone else want to have a go? Thanks. Absorption. And this, of course, this threefold description of samadhi being only from the commentaries, not found in the suttas at all. And the interesting thing here is that according to this very clear statement in the Visuddhimagga, that it's only when you have matured and perfected the five kinds of rapture, when you've matured and perfected the two kinds of tranquility and the two kinds of bliss, that you can perfect the even Kanika Samadhi and Upachara Samadhi. These days, of course, Kanika Samadhi and sometimes Upachara Samadhi are essentially the foundation for the modern Vipassana schools, so like Goenka and Mahasi and so on. And they talk about that you only need Upachara Samadhi and you don't need jhana. And they're essentially meditation systems based on equanimity, so neutral feeling. So there's not the development of rapture and bliss and so on in those meditations. But according to the Visuddhimagga, that even those kinds of concentrations that you need to develop mature all of those kinds of rapture and bliss. So this is also a complicated question, the relationship between Kanika Samadhi and Upachara Samadhi. It's used in different ways by different teachers and so on. I won't go into the details here, but just to notice that how the Visuddhimagga is introducing this new framework. Okay.
The way they do it, to be correct, it seems to be like the Buddha taught things like in the Anapanasati Sutta, he said, you know, when it's
developed and perfected,
they leave the I can't remember the order, but there's
usually the four Satipatthanas will fulfill and develop the seven bhojangas, and then the seven bhojangas will develop
and then here
there's an influence
when it's matured and perfected, it leads to tranquility, and then when that's matured and perfected, it leads to supreme.
Yeah.
That's matured and perfected, it leads to reminded me the way it does it, things that I read in
the suttas,
but
yeah. Referring
to different things,
yeah.
But using the same way.
It's just, similar idiom, yeah. Very much so. So, of these, what's intended in this context by rapture is pervasive rapture, which is the root of absorption, the root of jhana, and comes into growth into association with absorption, the jhana. Oh, sorry, I should have mentioned that. Apana samadhi, it just means the four jhanas. Okay, so in other words, it's described the five kinds of rapture, and it says the one that we actually mean here in the first jhana is the last kind, the fifth kind, the pervasive rapture. But moving on to discuss sukha, it says sukha is bliss, pleasing is bliss. Then it says it thoroughly devours and consumes bodily and mental affliction, Thus it is bliss, this being a series of puns found in the Pali, which we can't reproduce in the English. It has gratifying as its characteristic. Its intention, its function is to intensify associated dhammas. It's manifested as aid. Now here the more interesting part of it is the relationship between the two. Now whenever the two, rapture and bliss, are associated, rapture is the contentedness at getting a desirable object and bliss is the actual experiencing of it when got. When there is happiness, when there is rapture, there is bliss. But when there is bliss, there is not necessarily rapture. Okay, so it being, of course, the in the third jhana, there is bliss, but there's no rapture. Rapture is included in the khanda, in the sankhara khanda, and sukha is included in the feeling khanda, the vedana khanda. So this is being the abhidhamma systematization of it. So rapture, piti, is regarded as being in the sankhara khanda. In other words, what that suggests is that that piti is more of a response. It's an emotional response to the experience. The sankhara has a more active feeling about it, whereas the sukha is has a more passive feeling. Personally, I don't agree with that classification, but this is the point that it's trying to make by making the classification. If a man exhausted in a desert saw or heard about a pond on the edge of a wood, he would have rapture. If he went into the wood's shade and used the water, he would have bliss. And it should be understood that this is said because they are obvious on such occasions. That's why they've used that example. Okay, so you're starving in the desert, you hear there's an oasis of water, and so the excitement, the thrill arises looking forward to it, and when you're actually drinking the cool water and sitting in the shade, you experience the sukha. And then there's a sort of grammatical discussion, which is not that interesting. Okay, and then it talks about the final words in the formula, upasampadya viharati. And I haven't actually talked about this, but I should mention this briefly. Upasampadya is actually upa, sam, and pada is the root. And it's the same root as the root upasampada, the ordination. And so it has a meaning of like entrance into, something like that. It's usually translated enters and dwells. Viharati is a verb which is used specifically in Pali to mean sustained over time. Okay? So this is specifically what viharati means. To enter and dwell in it means you, the same as the English word to dwell. You know, he was dwelling over that thought. He was dwelling over the problem before making a decision. To dwell over something is to take your time over it. So the viharati specifically means that it's a state that lasts. So that's an important thing to remember, that one enters into it and it actually lasts for a period of time. This is why it's called viharati. Okay?
So it can't be a moment.
Exactly, yeah.
Sorry, I missed what the context of the Upasampadya, I thought
it was it. This happens at the end of the jhana formula, Patamang jhana upasampadya viharati.
Yeah, but
so,
in this context,
what does it mean? Yes, well, it's a similar meaning when you have an upasampada, you enter into a community, don't you? Yeah? So you sort of become. There's a sort of, the Sangha is a community with boundaries, and then you come inside that, you're accepted within it. Yeah? So it's a similar meaning there. It's used in a few places in unusual contexts. It usually has that kind of meaning. There's one place where it says that you enter and abide in the suttas, which were spoken by the Tathagata. So you have I'm not quite sure what it means there, where you can enter and abide in the suttas. But in any case, normally it has that kind of meaning, going into viharati, dwelling over time. So the Visuddhimagga's explanation is upasampadya arrives at, reaches, or else making it enter, then producing it in the Vibhanga. It's the Abhidhamma Vibhanga. It says It means the gaining, the regaining, the reaching, arrival, touching, realizing, entering upon the first jhana. Dwells in, by becoming possessed of jhana of the kind described above through dwelling in a posture favorable to that jhana, he produces a posture, a procedure, a keeping, an enduring, a lasting, a behavior, a dwelling of the person. For this is said in the Abhidhamma Vibhanga. Dwells in means poses, proceeds, keeps, endures, lasts, behaves, dwells, hence dwells, is said. So don't worry yourself too much about the meaning of all those things. It's just a list of what in the Pali should really be synonyms. But obviously the general meaning is clear enough there. And now I'm just wondering how much to go on with these. We should go, yeah, because we read the abandons five factors and possesses five factors. Here in the abandoning of the five factors is the abandoning of the five hindrances. The mind affected through lust by greed for varied objective fields does not become concentrated on an object consisting in unity. Or, being overwhelmed by lust, it does not enter on the way to abandoning the sense desire element. When pestered by ill will towards an object, it does not occur uninterruptedly. When overcome by stiffness and torpor, it is unwieldy. When seized by agitation and worry, it is unquiet and buzzes about. When stricken by uncertainty, it fails to mount the way to accomplish the attainment of jhana. So there is only that these are called factors of abandoning because they are specifically obstructive to jhana. But applied for vitakka directs the mind onto the object, vichara keeps it anchored there. Happy rapture, produced by the success of the effort, refreshes the mind, whose effort has succeeded through not being distracted by those hindrances, and bliss intensifies it for the same reason. Then, one-pointedness of mind, ekagata, aids in by this directing onto this anchoring, this refreshing, and this intensifying evenly and rightly centers the mind with its remaining associated states on the object consisting in unity. So here it's talking about the fifth jhana factor, ekagata, which I'll come on to in just a minute. Consequently, possession of five factors should be understood as the arising of these five, namely vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata, one-pointedness. For it is when these are arisen that jhana is said to be arisen, which is why they're called the five factors of possession. But jhana is not something, goes on to say, jhana is not something different from those factors. Okay, and while those five factors, the five jhana factors, are present also at the moment of access, and are, that is at threshold concentration, and are still and are stronger in threshold concentration than in normal consciousness, they are still stronger here than in threshold concentration and acquire the characteristic of the fine material sphere, that is the rupa-yatana. For vitakka arises here, directing the mind onto the object in an extremely lucid manner. And vichara does so, pressing the object very hard, and the rapture and bliss pervade the entire body. Hence it is said, and there is nothing of his whole body not permeated by the happiness, the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, of course being a quote from Samanyapala Sutta itself. And unification too, ekagata, arises in the complete contact with the object that the surface of a box's lid has with the surface of its base. Okay, so this is how these qualities differ from the same qualities which are experienced before jhana. Okay, now just to mention that the factor of ekagata is not actually listed in the normal jhana formula. Okay, so one pointed is not mentioned until the second jhana. It is, however, mentioned elsewhere in the suttas, which mention the five jhana factors. So this first jhana obviously does have one pointedness, but perhaps the one pointedness is not as strong yet as it is in the second jhana, hence being why it's mentioned there. So that's probably enough. The it goes on to talking about goes on to talk about it in quite a lot more detail, but that's enough for now. So it gives one story about how we're supposed to master the jhana. Okay, so before his admission to Venerable Buddha Rakita, 8 years after his ordination, he was sitting in the midst of. That's interesting enough. 8 years after his ordination. It's interesting. It says 8 years after his admission to the Sangha, that elder, that Thera, was sitting in the midst of 30,000 bhikkhus. So he's called a Thera, even though he's only ordained for 8 years. He was sitting in the midst of 30,000 monks. All of them had supernatural powers, and they'd gathered to attend upon the sickness of an elder Maharohanogutta at Terambatala. He saw a royal Supanna, right, the Garuda bird, swooping down from the sky, intending to seize an attendant royal Naga serpent as he was getting rice gruel accepted for the elder. Okay, so they had a sick monk. The Naga had come down to attend upon the sick monk by offering him rice gruel, and this Garuda, because the Nagas and Garudas always at war with each other, was swooping down to get to seize the Naga. And as the bird swept down, the Garuda swept down, the elder Buddha Rakita created a rock with his psychic powers, and seizing the royal Naga by the arm, he pushed him inside it. The royal Supanna gave the rock a blow and made off. And then the senior monk in the community remarked, he said, "Friends, if Rakita hadn't been here, we would all have been put to shame." So that's how fast you've got to be able to get into jhana, okay? So that's good enough for today, and that's the first jhana. And we'll have a look, continue this tomorrow, next week. So let's finish by paying respect.